Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
Providing insight and resources for your spiritual journey. Unity Online Radio.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, and I'm coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Today I welcome to the show the author of the book, The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. Will Tuttle has a PhD in the philosophy of education. He's a professional pianist, composer, and teacher. He's has been trained as a Zen Buddhist monk and worked extensively in Tai Chi, yoga, meditation, intuition development. He presents at New Thought churches and vegetarian and human potential conferences and intentional communities throughout the country. Mine, that's a lot of things, isn't it? So it's a joy, therefore, to welcome Will Tuttle to today's show. Welcome, Will.
Thank you so much, Reverend Paul, for having me on Unity Radio, and welcome also to all the people who are listening.
Excellent. You know, the book, which I found to be elegantly written and very persuasive, is a clarion call for veganism, right? Basically, that's its bottom line.
Right. Yeah, I would say that. It is a clarion call for vegan living and for questioning the official storage of our culture around human superiority and domination and exploitation of other animals. That's the main point and the benefits of that.
And you, you know, you lay it out very elegantly. Like I said, it's tracing it back to really the herding culture, right, which replaced earlier forms of agriculture, and we've been dealing with this now for the last almost 5,000 years, I guess, and it's alive and well, as you write in your book, you know, in America too. You know, the whole ethos of America is based on sort of the cowboy paradigm in a way, isn't it? And the domination system of, you know, moving west and reclaiming the land, you know, from the savages, so to speak, which is a total misnomer, of course, but that's sort of the mentality of it, and we see it, you know, historically through the whole of the Middle East, and then through Europe, this culture, which you say is very aggressive, yes?
Right, yeah.
Male-dominated.
Right, yeah, that's a very good analysis, I think. And in the World Peace Diet, in the second chapter, I kind of go into that. I think it's really required reading for anyone who's serious about making spiritual progress in this lifetime, because if we don't understand our culture and the cultural programming that we've all endured and the wounding we've all endured at the hands of our culture, then we're not really able, I don't think, to heal ourselves. And so this is something that is, I think, the routine and relentless mistreatment of animals, primarily for food, but for clothing and entertainment and other products, is a massive system. You know, it's a huge industrialized killing machine that we're all born into from the time we're little infants, And we're not given a choice in it, typically. We're just forced to eat the flesh of horribly abused animals from the time of little infants. You go to any grocery store and look in the baby food section, we'll just see turkey, veal, chicken, beef, cheese, and all these products that are the products of violence, of imprisonment and enslavement of other living beings, and also of impregnating these animals against their will. So there's an enormous amount of sexual violence involved in animal agriculture that's all covered over, too. And so we're actually eating that. We're feeding it to our children. But the point is, I think I really try to emphasize in the World Peace Diet is to understand the historical perspective that, this was something that began, apparently, as far as we can tell from researchers, in about 8,000 to 10,000 years ago in what is today Iraq. And for the first time, people started owning wild sheep, and then wild goats, and then about 2,000 years later, wild cows. And this changed everything. It was about four things, I guess, that it introduced very gradually over probably a 5,000 to 7,000 year period. And I remember I used to teach college courses in the Epic of Gilgamesh, the Iliad, the Odyssey, the ancient Old Testament writings, the ancient Greek tragedies, and so forth. And you see, by that time, these four things have really developed in the West and spread, and they're spreading today throughout the whole world. And those four things are, number one, the rise of a wealthy elite class, a tiny minority of men who are wealthy and powerful. They're called the kings, basically, in the Old Testament and in the Greek plays and things. And those kings are controlling, really, in a not in a healthy way, the lives of the people and of animals, and they invented war. There had never been war on this planet until we started owning animals as property for food. The first word for war is the ancient Sanskrit word gavya, which means the desire for more cows. So when they would see another king with cows and sheep and goats, they would go and try to steal them, and that would lead to the first large-scale battles and wars, and it was a really, I don't recommend anyone reading about it because it's not for the faint of heart to read about those early wars. And also, they also invented slavery. There had never been slavery before either on the planet, but what I've discovered in my research into the World Peace Diet is that whatever we do to animals, sooner or later, we do to each other. And so it's a small step from breaking up the families of animals and owning them as property and enslaving them. And of course, we know how that's happened, slavery and the breaking up of families and so forth has happened throughout human history. And then the other thing, the fourth one, is the domination of the sacred feminine. I refer to the sacred feminine in the World Peace Diet as Sophia. Sophia was the ancient Greek goddess of wisdom, and this represents a capacity within all human beings to love and nurture and protect life, and this beautiful foundation, really, for healthy families, healthy society, healthy neighborhoods. It's caring, it's unconditional love for another. And what I've discovered, though, is that when we raise children in a system where they're forced from the time of little infants to participate in meals of terrible abuse and enslavement of other living beings, we just shut down that capacity, the capacity of intelligence and making connections, of looking deeply, feeling deeply, caring deeply. We desensitize people. And so when we have that happening, we have a disconnectedness with the sacred feminine, and we have the arising of a patriarchal culture based on war and domination of women and female animals, where they're seen as mere breeders to be used for accumulating wealth and for sexual pleasure. And this is a society that spread throughout the whole Eastern Mediterranean to the Northern Mediterranean, up into Central Asia and over into Europe, and then from there, of course, to the Americas and Africa. I just got back, actually, yesterday from a lecture tour in Ireland, England, and Holland, and a couple of weeks before that in the Middle East and in South Africa, and you can really see it. I mean, it's so obvious, but the average person, we're not aware of it, just how forests have been destroyed, how wild animals are being wiped out. We're in the largest mass extinction of other species and loss of genetic diversity in 65 million years. There's a real attack on the environment now that we have technology and the population numbers. So we're cutting down an acre of rainforest every second. We're overfishing the oceans to the point where scientists are saying that by the year, just in 20 or 30 years, there won't be any fish left at all. A lot of times people are now especially in Australia, have to go out and try to catch jellyfish because the fish are basically gone because we're catching fish to feed to cows and pigs and other animals. It's called enriching the feed and feeding them fish meal. So this whole system is based on a war, essentially, against nature and animals and the sacred feminine. And it's invisible, and we don't like to talk about it. And in my experience, even traveling to progressive churches, Unity Unitarian and Centers for Spiritual Living and other, you know, and Buddhists and all these different groups, for the most part, even people on a spiritual path are uncomfortable actually taking responsibility for the ramifications of their actions. And, Paul, I think it's because they're just, you know, it's something we're doing, but we never chose to do freely. You know, we're just all forced into it from the time we're little infants to eat animal foods. And so we just, you know, and we have these stories like the protein story and the calcium story and the human superiority story to justify all this. But it's really, I think, wonderful to realize that we don't have to participate in that anymore. And I think it's really the power of community to help us heal this. You know, I was raised in a community in Boston, Massachusetts, Concord, Massachusetts, back in the 1950s, and I remember learning how to eat animals, foods, of course, and we ate lots of meat, dairy products, and eggs. And I remember when I was about 7 years old, I said to my mother, you know, hey, Mom, the kind of food we're eating, is this what everybody eats? And my mother said, yeah, this is what everybody eats. And then she said, and then she came back a few minutes later. I said, okay, thanks. And then she said, well, there are vegetarians. And then she said, but don't worry, you'll never meet one.
Yeah,
I remember, you know, that was true, you know, and I never met one. But so the only reason I was eating meat and dairy was because of the communities I was raised in. You know, all of us are products of our communities. And anthropologists understand this, that the primary way that any society transmits its values from generation to generation is through rituals, and the primary ritual in any society are the meals of that culture where people sit down together and eat food together. And so that's why the greatest, I believe, adventure of self-discovery, liberation, and spiritual empowerment is the journey of looking deeply into our culture's food system where we can see the invisible violence and the blockages to our natural sensitivity and the numbing and disconnectedness and denial that is injected into all of us, the mentality of privilege and elitism, of entitlement and might makes right. You know, we're trying to create a society of justice and freedom and equality, and yet every meal is a ritual where we actually inject into our children and into each other the exact opposite of that. We inject into us into each other a mentality of exploitation and domination and violence and might makes right, that whoever is more powerful can dominate and exploit the weak. But this is the exact opposite of what Jesus was teaching and the Buddha and all the great spiritual teachings and teachers. And so I think for today, it's really all about vegan living, understanding what that is. And it's just a new word, I think, Paul, for ahimsa. You know, ahimsa is the ancient Sanskrit teaching, which means non-violence, basically. Another way to say it, I think, would be loving kindness, because the basic teaching is that as soon as I harm another for my own benefit, I harm myself more than I harm them. I create a consciousness that's dull, that's crass, that's not sensitive really to the violence that we're inflicting on others. And we create a world of competition, and we create a world where corporations and large financial institutions and governmental agencies like the World Bank and the IMF and all them, you know, they can basically destroy our ecosystems and invade our lives with advertising targeting our children that is not in their best interest at all. And so for me, it was a community. I left home when I was right after college, and I tried to get to San Francisco with my brother walking. You know, we walked for quite a few months, and we got as far as Tennessee, actually, after, I guess, about 4 or 5 months of walking. And in Tennessee, we ended up staying for a while at a community called The Farm. And in 1975, The Farm was the largest hippie commune in the world. There were almost 900 people living there, mostly from California, and they were eating a completely plant-based diet. So we would today call The Farm a vegan community, but no one heard of the word vegan. It's a word that was invented by the British wonderful person, Donald Watson, who was in the Vegetarian Society. And so that's a word that really applies to all exploitation of animals. But so it was vegan in the sense that there was no meat, no dairy, no eggs. I remember this guy even telling me Yeah, I'm even wearing vegetarian shoes. So I realize, you know, even you don't buy leather that causes violence to animals. And so for me, it was that example of seeing a living community of 900 people, probably 200 children, most of them vegan from birth. They were thriving. And that was it. I talked to them about it. I asked, why are you doing it? You know, why are you vegetarians? And they said, well, there's two main reasons. One is most of the grain we're growing, we're feeding to animals. Well, people are starving, and the food shortages and the hunger and starvation of millions of our brothers and sisters, hundreds of millions actually, is the driving force behind conflict and war. And we want to, you know, we want to actually walk our talk and help create a world where peace and freedom and justice are actually possible. So we want to eat lower on the food chain. And then the other thing, you said, you know what the animals go through that people are eating? And I remember just saying, no, I don't want to hear about it. You know, he just said just a few phrases that, you know, just some of the routine mutilations and violence that animals go through. And when he did that, it was for me, it was like the Wizard of Oz when Toto pulls the curtain back. And I suddenly could see that we live in a society where we have all these platitudes about how we're good, loving, kind, peaceful people. Yet if I was born as a cow or a pig or a chicken or a fish, human beings are stabbing and mutilating and imprisoning and stealing babies and impregnating against my will on rape racks. I mean, this just horrific violence toward not just millions, but literally billions of animals. And so I realized when that curtain was pulled back, and I had this wonderful example of about, you know, 900 people who were thriving on a plant-based diet. We were eating meals together of vegetables and grains and potatoes and things. Then that was it. You know, I never had eaten meat in my life since that day, and that was 40 years ago. And about 5 years later, I came out to California, and I heard about the routine violence to cows and hens for dairy products and eggs. So I became what's called a vegan in 1980, and then a few years later I shaved my head and lived for the second time in my life at Sungwangsa Zen Monastery in Korea, South Korea. And I found myself there actually for the second time in my life in a vegan community, and this one, though, had been practicing vegan living for about 750 years, you know, since the 1200s. There was no meat, dairy, eggs, no wool, silk, leather, fur. You know, it was just a whole community based on intensive meditation, where we would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and meditate from 3 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and in silence for 3 months is a typical retreat. And I think when people meditate with diligence, we begin to become more sensitive to the ramifications and the consequences of our actions and our thoughts. And so I think it's not surprising that these meditation communities move in that direction. And I think, you know, we live in a society, essentially, where human beings are really encouraged not to be mindful, not to be conscious, to be always busy, to be trying to get something for ourselves, the sense of being a fundamentally separate self, having to compete with others for a limited amount of things. And, of course, animals who have no protection. So while there's some protection for other human beings, perhaps, depending on their class, their race, their gender, animals have basically are property. They have property status. They're just like a sack of cement or potatoes. They talk about harvesting animals like they're just potatoes or killing them. And you know, anyone who's had a dog or a cat and gotten to know non-human animals knows that these animals have interests. They have the capacity to suffer, and that their interests are to them as important to our interests are to us. So, in order to participate in the typical most pervasive rituals in our society, just sitting together with other human beings and eating food together, we have to systematically repress and deaden our natural spiritual awareness. And so is it any wonder why we don't have a whole lot of actual progress in our spiritual life, in creating a society where peace and freedom and justice have a foundation? We find more and more terrorism and other things happening. So the good news, I think, is that there's nothing stopping anyone from making an effort to understand the consequences of our food choices. There's nothing stopping us except for fear and the yearning to kind of just keep a habit going and to please other people. And that's sort of keeping these blinders on, because the only reason anyone eats animal food is because of essentially this this way of living that is forced on us, and so we're just following orders, essentially. People are just following orders that came to them from the people all of us trusted completely. You know, my own mother, my father, my minister, my teacher, my government, my corporations, my banks, my doctor. You know, all these people totally agree. And so we've been injected against our will with these orders that we have to eat the flesh and secretions of abused animals, and we've never been able to actually, most of us actually question it. Because we don't have communities where we are able to question it. So it's very difficult. I don't think I could ever have changed my way of living and gone vegetarian and then subsequently vegan without the example of other people who are doing that. You know, that's why I think it's so precious for us to try to create communities of sanity and sustainability and freedom and conscious awareness and meditative awareness. And I think that's really what a lot of the unity movement, of course, is all about. It's about creating communities that are actually healthy for our spiritual awakening. And I'm just so glad to see that more and more people in our world today are changing. And I think we're right poised at the beginning of a real massive resurrection of Sophia. That the numbers of people going vegan, vegetarian, typically, and then vegan, is really growing quickly, and I've been, you know, kind of following statistics on that. But I just, like today, you know, just a couple of days ago in Holland and everywhere we've been going, you know, just 5 years ago there was virtually no vegan movement. There was no vegan restaurants, there were no vegan groups. It was basically nothing. And today it's huge. We had 12,000 people coming to the vegan conference in Brighton. We had about 4,000 or 5,000 to the conference in Utrecht, and there are just, you know, it's really the movement, I think, of a positive future. You know, if we're going to have a future for our children, then this is a step that it's not an option. I mean, I think we're all called to question the violence on our plates and move in that direction. And then I think we truly can create a world of harmony and peace and freedom and abundance for everyone. And if we fail to do that, then the old the patriarchal war machine with a wealthy elite dominating humanity and animals and nature will just continue. And as Einstein said, I think very clearly, you know, he said we will then drift toward unparalleled catastrophe. We can't go on with this mentality of exploitation and violence and non-inclusion. You know, vegan living is really nothing to be proud of.
Okay, folks, we're at the break right now.
Okay, thanks.
Join us after this break. Listen to these messages from Unity.
Wouldn't you like to share the programs that inspire you most with audiences around the world? That's easier than ever with mobile giving. Just text Unity Radio to 72727 and help us continue offering spiritual programs that change lives.
Someone once said there are two ways to get to the top of an oak tree. Climb the tree or plant an acorn and wait. If we expect changes to happen in our lives, we may want to consider climbing. Plus, changes needn't be monumental. Sometimes it's as easy as an attitude shift. Life is what we bring to it. Do you have a job that seems less than exciting? When you walk through the door, bring joy with you. Life looks better when viewed through a positive attitude. Are you facing a health challenge or surgery? Get rid of your fears by focusing instead on Spirit working in and through you. When you remember that with God all things are possible, your outlook cannot help but change. Today, wherever you go, whatever you face, do so with joyous expectations. Release your inner splendor and allow the light and love of God to guide your way.
This mindful moment is brought to you by Daily Word Magazine. Finding time for the positive reminders in Daily Word is easy with the digital edition, perfect for smartphones and readers on the go. Give it a test run with our 30-day free trial offer. Learn more at unityonlineradio.org/dailyword.
I will leave this world. The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find my God.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or, if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Will Tuttle, and he's written a wonderful book called The World Peace Diet. And as you can tell from the first segment, he's very passionate about these ideas and can explicate them very well. But I wanted to also interject a few ideas here, because not everybody buys into this paradigm, you know, of everybody becoming vegan. And that everybody that isn't a vegan is sort of evil in some way, you know, and buying into this domination system. And, you know, I understand, you know, that way of looking at things. But, you know, I muse about, say, Buddhist societies in Sri Lanka and then Buddhist societies in Thailand. You know, they're both Theravada tradition of Buddhism. But, you know, the cultural heritage of Sri Lanka is basically vegetarian in terms of food. But if you go to Thailand, you know, they eat everything under the sun, you know, literally, and some gross things too, you know, even our Western, even if you're a meat eater, you know, you might want not eat the fresh blood soups and all this that they eat up in parts of Thailand. So, you know, both Buddhist cultures, but approaching this very differently. And yet, the folks in Thailand would probably say, you know, we're very mindful in what we do, and we respect the animals that we kill, etc. So, is it possible? You know, if for instance, in we have halal meat in the Islamic tradition, and you have kosher food in the Judaic tradition, you know, where there's a certain amount of mindfulness around the killing of animals and certain prescriptions about how, you know, how to kill and everything, in order to create some kind of honor for those creatures. So is that possible, do you think?
Right. Yes, Paul. You know, first of all, I just want to emphasize that vegan living is never, never, never about saying that people who eat meat or dairy are evil. And that's completely not true. It's the whole World Peace Diet message is that we're wounded. You know, we're hurt. We're harmed by being raised in a violent culture. And, you know, the culture itself is based on domination, exploitation. And maybe 10,000 years ago, people thought they had to do that. I don't really have any problem with people 10,000 years ago doing that. But it's basically just saying it's obsolete. You know, it may be back then people needed to eat animal foods because of where they were living and to survive and all that. But we can see today it's utterly not in our best interest. So it's just basically being pragmatic. I think we all have a natural sense of empathy and kindness for animals, and it's clear that we're healthier, you know, eating a plant-based diet. I haven't been to a doctor in 40 years, and basically vegans have much lower rates of disease than people who are eating, meat, dairy products, and eggs. So from the environmental health and ethical points of view, it's not being, nothing to do with evil. It's just seeing that it's an obsolete system that we're all essentially forced to participate in. And so, yeah, people have always felt, I think, a very deep regret at stabbing and killing animals who are innocent and to punish them. And I think we all know that it makes no difference if we thank the animals. I mean, if I was to, you know, attack a guy and steal his watch and then say, well, or impregnate, you know, rape somebody or something, and then later thank them for their, you know, I mean, violence and thanking has nothing to do with it. I mean, violence is violence, and it's unnecessary. So there's really just seeing that we're all programmed, and people, and, you know, I had a very interesting experience because I was in, a couple of years ago, I went to Taiwan and gave lectures there, and in Taiwan and Korea, the Buddhist culture is vegan, and it's very clearly vegan, and there's no meat, dairy, or eggs or leather in their Buddhist monasteries, and they're really promoting it. And so when I gave a lecture in Taipei, over 2,000 people showed up to hear me speak because the Buddhist organizations promoted it, you know, to all their people. And so it was huge, and they loved it. And then later, I was on my way to Australia to speak there, and there's a Thai Buddhist center that is very large, and the students of the teacher wanted me to speak there, and the teacher said, no, we're not going to have anyone talk about this because this is not, this could maybe divide the Sangha. And it's very interesting. He was a young British vegetarian. He went to Thailand when he was, you know, 20 years old, and he told his teachers that he was a vegetarian. He didn't want to eat meat. And they told him, in no uncertain terms, that if you want to go out begging for food and people put meat in your bowl, then you better eat it. And so now he won't allow anyone to talk about vegetarianism. It's kind of an interesting thing where, I think spiritual teaching should actually increase our sensitivity, not decrease them. But I think this is a case where that happened because, I think, you know, I've talked to quite a few people in Thailand about this, and it's pretty clear if you go back into this ancient Buddhist sutras that the original teachings explicitly include animals, and not to kill explicitly includes animals. You could argue in the Ten Commandments maybe not to kill as much for humans, but for the Buddhists, it explicitly kills. So they have to do various forms of juggling the teachings in order to justify this. Like the animal, you can do it if the animal wasn't killed specifically for you. But if you, obviously, if you go to a store and buy some meat or someone gives you some, they're going to, it's actually, that maybe wasn't killed specifically for you, but then they're going to have to replace that meat with some other meat. So that animal will be specifically killed. So it's, I think, essentially, you know, there's positive things happening. I think the Thai monks are moving toward veganism. The Tibetan monks are moving toward veganism. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese are all vegan. So there is definitely a move in that direction. And I think the Western societies really, in many ways, are to blame for increasing the amount of meat in these cultures, actually. And we see that in Japan and a lot of other places, too. So it's quite complex, but it's a great question. And I think, you know, it's good to minimize violence. That's what the teachings are all about.
Yeah, and I have experience with that too. I got a good friend who was a Buddhist monk in that tradition. You know, spent many years in Thailand initially, and also in Sri Lanka, and India, and then Britain. But you know, when he was in Thailand, like you said, they're on arms round, and they, you know, often they're given a lot of rice, obviously, because that's a staple. But they're also given lots of different kinds of meat, and you know, they bless it and eat it, you know, because that's what they're given, so they have to accept it. Even though, you know, he was a vegetarian himself at the time and didn't really want to do this, but felt like, you know,
right,
he had to honor what was given. Whereas when he was in Sri Lanka, you know, no problem because it was
right,
pretty much purely vegetarian diet. You know,
right,
let me be a devil's advocate here.
Sure.
I live in Texas, okay, and therefore, you know, meat is huge. And I'm married to a lady who grew up in Dallas, and, you know, she loves her steaks and everything. I think, you know, because she was brought up on it, like you say. I don't know if it's indoctrination or just cultural, whatever. And so, you know, for her, it's like that's a natural part of being alive. You know, you need your protein, steak tastes good, et cetera. And, you know, we pride ourselves here in all our barbecue joints and you know, the way it's prepared, and it's, you know, it's marinated and cooked for days and all this, you know, and it's lifted up as a wonderful thing. So, you know, and like we said earlier, it's tied into the sort of the cowboy culture, you know, and
right.
The sort of, you know, non-American, if you like, you know, an American activity, you know, being a vegan.
Right.
And so, you know, how do you respond to those people? Because, you know, they're proud of it. Let's put it like that. Proud of the tradition of it.
Right, right. Well, I think, you know, it's just, like you say, it's something that the only reason she's doing it is because she was forced into it from the time she was a little kid by people she trusted completely, her parents, teachers, ministers, and everybody. And so it's something that we choose. If she had been raised at the farm in Tennessee, in a vegan community, I'm sure she probably would be vegan. I mean, if our whole culture was, you know, that would be what we would be doing. So essentially, you know, we're products of our society. You know, I've talked to people who love to eat meat in Texas, and I've said to them, you really love to eat roast beef. And they'll say, oh, yeah, I couldn't give that up. Then I say, but would you like to eat dog? And they say, dog, are you kidding me? I would never. He said, dog, I love dogs. I would never eat them. I wouldn't harm them. And then I you know, I was in Korea, and I remember very clearly talking to people there, some guys about it. And I said, you know, could you ever give up dog? And they said, no. I mean, dog soup is, like, so delicious. I could never give it up. I say, how about roast beef? Oh, we would never eat cows. And that's the most terrible thing, to kill these magnificent animals, these large animals, cows. I mean, that's hideous, you know. So it's basically just indoctrination that's invisible, and we attach to it. You know, we have a sense of being a fundamentally separate self, and then we have these memories, and we maybe go into the house, and we're 4 or 5 years old, and we smell the pot roast cooking, and we know it's our mother making it for us, and that means she loves us. So when we smell that, we feel loved, and you know, there's these very deep connections. And if we go vegan, it means actually liberating ourselves from the domination of our parents and society, and actually making choices and being aware of the ramifications of our actions. And since 97% of the people are not vegan, you know, it's very easy to do. It's like, you know, slavery. I mean, it was, people were very proud of owning slaves 150 years ago, and they felt, and they would go to church on Sunday morning, and the minister would say, isn't it wonderful that we live in this wonderful world where God has created an order where we have, you know, white people, of course, are superior, and then black people are inferior, and this is the way God created it, and it sure is fantastic. We're very grateful for this. It says it in the Holy Book. And we look back on that now, and we can see how utterly horrible it was in its effects, and how it dehumanized people and devastated relationships on every level. And it's the same thing with animals. I mean, it's not healthy. It's actually heart disease, cancer, liver disease, and then all of the psychological problems that people have, I think, can be traced. And actually, Charles Fillmore talked about this himself, that he could not go to a higher level spiritually until he stopped eating animal foods. And he was actually a vegan before the word vegan was even invented, because he didn't eat dairy either. I've spent quite a bit of time in the Unity Library looking into this whole thing, and I'm just delighted that the founders of Unity were humble enough, in a sense, to just say, you know, we're going to have compassion, not just for people, but for ecosystems and animals, and create, as best we can, a movement based on kindness. And that was always, Unity was always vegetarian. It was known for that for decades, until the 60s, when they switched over to eating meat.
Yeah, and that's true. You know, the Unity Inn was vegetarian, and even when I was in school there in the 80s, you know, they were still talking about the you know, they had one vegetarian dish, you know, that was delicious. But now, of course, they have salads and things. You can get vegetarian, but it's definitely switched over to mostly meat. And so that whereas something, a tradition like the Seventh Day Adventist, you know, is still predominantly vegetarian, because that's one of the pillars of their belief system. And I think they've done studies that show that, you know, they live longer and they're healthier as a denomination than any other denomination, which is interesting, which sort of bolsters what you're saying, that it is a healthier diet to have a plant-based diet. My daughter and her husband are vegetarian. I mean, they still eat cheese and some eggs and everything, so they're they're ovo-lacto vegetarians, but they don't, they eat fish as well, I guess. But they certainly don't eat any kind of meat or of any kind. And, you know, so they're bringing their daughter up that way. So, you know, there's a shift there, which is good.
Right.
But, of course, you advocate no fish, no eggs, no cheese, you know, none of that, right? The vegan diet is completely plant-based.
Right, yeah, that's a good point. So it's no meat or dairy or eggs, no honey also or bee products, and no leather and silk and wool and fur and down. And I'm telling you, I mean, I've been researching this for 35 years, and when you look behind the curtain of all these industries and see the horrific violence that these animals have to endure for these products, you know, I would never, never, ever, ever want to participate. And the only reason you know, people don't continue on and don't question it is just because we have very powerful advertising and very powerful programming, and the largest corporations, the largest industries in the planet are essentially the pharmaceutical, medical industry, the war industry, and the animal agriculture and chemical industries, and all of them depend completely on animal agriculture for their profits. You know, I haven't been, like I said, I haven't been to a doctor in 40 years. I haven't bought one drug. I haven't been to a drugstore in 40 years. You know, it's just, my mother's the only one in her retirement center. She's 87, who's not on some kind of pharmaceutical pill. She's the only vegan, too. And my wife's, you know, mother's 96 and is a vegan, and they wouldn't be probably still alive if they hadn't gone vegan. So, you know, just from a pure self-centered point of view of wanting to be healthy and happy and celebrate my life on this beautiful earth with lots of energy, but I don't think it's actually self-centered, because anyone who's healthy and so forth and has lots of energy is actually a benefit to society. People who are sick all the time, I mean, I see this so many times. I see these women who are vegan or vegetarian, and they have husbands that want to eat meat. And then they end up having to spend, you know, maybe 10 or 20 or 30 years taking care of somebody after he has a stroke. They become slaves, you know, because he wanted to eat his meat. You know, so I think, you know, compassion for other people, for slaughterhouse workers, you know, slaughterhouse workers, if I take out my wallet and pay for meat or dairy or eggs, I'm paying someone somewhere to impregnate female animals on rape racks, to steal their babies and to stab them. And these people have the highest rates of worker-related injuries, highest rates of drug addiction, alcoholism, and spousal abuse, since they have, you know, this problem. So Charles Fillmore, and I think really the Apostle Paul and Jesus, you know, they all emphasize the importance of not causing our brother to stumble, you know, not doing something that's going to force other human beings to do things that harden their hearts and make them violent and abusive, and then they go back and kill themselves or get drunk or, you know, those kinds of things. Because Charles Fillmore talked about this a lot, too. So I think on every level, you know, we can say, oh, it tastes good, I like it, you know, but that's no excuse. That's completely unethical to harm another because I like it. I mean, there's no foundation for that at all. It's utterly absurd.
Yeah. I actually think St. Paul was omnivore, because he advocated that all kinds of food were, you know, legal.
Right.
And had a dream about it, right, where he saw the mats laid with all kinds of food. But I think, you know, I think the tradition there is that there's no Gentile or Jew, and that was the basic idea, that we're all one in spirit, and so there's no prescription against any kind of food, that all is lawful, if you like. And that's not necessarily advocating food, it's more like we're all in this together. So, you know, you could look at it in different ways there.
Can I say one quick thing about that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I've actually looked into this quite a bit, and we don't really know what happened, you know, 2,000 years ago, but there are some really interesting books, The Origins of Christianity, The Lost Religions of Jesus, and others, where scholars look at the writings of the original way back, you know, in the first one or two generations after Jesus passed away. When they talk about the early Christians, who were called Ebionites, they are absolutely unanimous that they ate no meat and or dairy. Actually, they were vegans, and it's very well known that this is. I mean, back then it was well known, and but that, you know, this is taking us somewhere else. But the Paul and Bartholomew who came later, who were not actual original disciples of Jesus, I mean, they wanted to make it more popular you know, so they could have more converts. And we see the same thing in Buddhism, we see the same thing in Unity. You know, people who come later, they don't want to have the discipline of that the original founders had. They want to open it up and have lots of customers, and have it, people can eat whatever they want, you know. And then, you know, like, we can go to war, we can go on holy wars, we can eat meat, we can drink alcohol. I mean, Jesus did not. They, if, according to the original people, they changed the scriptures, you know, to make it look like Jesus served fish and wine and all these things. Of course, it was out there were people called editores or that edited the scripture. So I think it's, again, it's good to question some of these things or do a little more research. If anyone's interested, I would just turn you to some of these books.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious, though, that Jesus may not have been a huge meat eater. We don't know, but he certainly was surrounded by fishermen, and he was often fishing. And one of the first meals that he had was in the resurrection. Was when he came back to the beach there and said, "Have you got anything to eat?" And there was a piece of fish right there grilling. So, and you know, his first miracle was turning water into wine. So, you know, at the very least, he was probably, and they called him a glutton and a drunkard, you know. So he probably did partake of a little alcohol and some fish. So he definitely wasn't a vegan, but I'm sure he was very mindful in his eating. And, you know, that's another question I have. You know, there's many diets out there, and one of the ones that they say is the most healthful is the Mediterranean diet, you know, which emphasizes a lot of non-meat products, you know, a lot of vegetables, a lot of plant-based things, but also some fish and some meat, you know, but less than we normally would eat because it's not healthy for us, but in moderation. So, you know, and that has a lot of antecedents. You know, people have been eating that diet healthily for thousands of years. Could it be that if you know, in the right proportion, that makes more sense, makes some kind of sense? You know, rather than just mindlessly killing stuff and eating huge amounts of meat.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think any time we reduce the quantity of animal foods concentrate toxins, heavy metals, PCBs, dioxins are highly concentrated, especially today with the pollution we have, nuclear radiation and so forth, in fish. And fish, of course, are fed to cows, pigs, and chickens. So when we're eating dairy products and eggs, and fish are extremely concentrated sources of pollution and toxins, plus there, of course, is a lot of terror and fear and pain. I refer to those things as metaphysical toxins. So basically, you know, animal protein, I mean, our body can deal with some animal protein. Obviously, we can do that. But I don't see any reason to do it. I mean, you know, it's sort of like I'm going to only stab and kill, you know, on Friday or something. And, you know, it's utterly unnecessary. There's a new book. It just came out. It's an Amazon, a New York Times bestseller by Dr. Michael Greger called How Not to Die. And he talks about the 17 leading causes of death. And what they are, you know, cancer, heart disease, and diabetes, various things, and analyzes them in depth. And 16 out of the 17 are directly caused by eating animal foods. And so the one that's not is accidents. And so I think, you know, we can, you know, people are doing better on a Mediterranean diet because they're reducing the amount of animal flesh and abuse that they're eating and causing. But again, from my point of view, you know, I'm in my 60s and I can run a mile faster than I could in my 20s. I mean, it's like really, you know, fantastic to eliminate violence and pollution, and there's no reason to have some, I don't think, unless we want to go along with other people, what they're doing, you know. But according to T. Colin Campbell, who's probably the most respected nutrition researcher in the world at this point, he says the optimal amount of animal protein in anyone's diet is zero. You know, so we can have, you know, if we have less, it's not something that we're freely choosing to eat. We're only eating it because we're forced into it. Like the cows. I mean, we don't think the cows should eat a little fish or a little meat, but they're eating lots of fish and they eat they eat pigs and chickens, and that's, you know, part of the procedure to fatten them up and make them give more milk. But it's to realize that they're being forced to eat this meat and dairy, because they're being exploited by the people who own them. And I think it's essentially the same thing. I mean, anyone who's eating meat and dairy in our society today is only doing it for one reason, and that's essentially because they're being exploited. They don't realize it, that they're being exploited. But, and, you know, as all the teachings say, whatever we sow, we will reap. If we exploit others, we'll be exploited, and we will become, you know, very often we pay people to stab animals, and then we find out there we are at one point lying on our back, you know, having a quadruple heart bypass, and we stabbed ourselves or something like that. So I really think the best thing is to just go all the way, but I think any move in that direction, of course, is helpful.
Right. There's a beautiful image, isn't there, in Buddhism, and you mentioned it in your book about the jeweled gnat, you know, that
right.
Tell us about it. But it's the idea that everything is interconnected. We're in a holographic universe also, where every part of the gnat, every jewel in the gnat is reflecting every other jewel. So there's only one of us here, in the sense that we're one with the divine, and we're one with each other. And so
right.
How does that influence what we're talking about today in terms of becoming a vegan?
Yeah, I think essentially it's awakening through meditation and through inner contemplation to the interconnectedness of all life, and that what I am is not a fundamentally separate self. And I have, it's kind of interesting, you know, I have something on our website, which is worldpeacediet.com. It's called the Veg Inspiration for the Day. And I send out a quote from the World Peace Diet every day for free, anybody who wants one. And the one for today, I just thought it's kind of good for this program. And this is what I wrote for it. It says, when love is born in our hearts, we want only the best for others, for we directly see them as ourselves. The imprisoning illusion of a fundamentally separate self struggling against other selves for its own rewards is transcended, and our life becomes dedicated to bringing peace, joy, and fulfillment to others. This brings us our greatest joy and is the flowering of the highest form of love, which is compassion. We must, if this process is actually happening in us, be drawn toward veganism, and it is in no way a limitation on us, but is the harmonious fulfillment of our own inner seeing. You know, so that's the basic point. I feel so and totally grateful that I was able to that these communities have helped me see that, you know, animals are not food, and I'm not giving up anything. You know, it's like people are afraid that, you know, they're going to give up something if they give up eating dog meat. But, you know, if we give up, there's so many delicious foods, and that's the beauty. Madeline, my wife, has YouTube videos on preparing lots of different breakfast, lunches, and dinners, and there's literally millions of vegan recipes online, and the actual culinary frontier at this point is vegan cuisine. I mean, this is where the future is. People are amazed at how delicious and satisfying and of course healthy vegan cuisine can be, and we're using in many ways cuisines from other parts of the world, you know, like world spirituality, and this idea of, you know, most cultures in the world were primarily plant-based outside of the West. So many of the, you know, the Thai and Indian and South American and Middle Eastern and so forth, these cuisines are basically vegan. And so it's very easy to, and it's very exciting, actually.
Yeah, cool. Folks, I'm with Will Tuttle, and if you want to find out more about all this, obviously you can check into his blog that he keeps, but also get hold of the book, The World Peace Diet, and it explains it very much more in detail than we've been able to cover today. And, you know, it'll make you think, and obviously Will's very committed and makes a very compelling case here, and makes you feel guilty if you didn't eat a little bit. You know, we're buying into this cruelty of this domination system. There's one story that we don't have time to tell the whole thing, but there's a beautiful part in the book where it's late at night, and he's in the wilderness coming back to his car, and he's exhausted. And as he comes up the hill towards the parking lot and the ridge, he senses something behind him, and an elk follows him for some distance, and then later on moves ahead. But the influence of that elk helps him get up the hill, but it's also the sanctity. It's part of that jeweled net, you know, that connectedness Mother Nature with our own nature. And it's a beautiful image, I think, of our codependence and interdependence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why would we want to hurt some magnificent creature like that? And it is a testimony, I think, to America that we have brought back species from extinction. You know, the elk, for instance, was almost wiped out in many parts of America. Now there's healthy populations again. So we can do this. You know,
right.
there is hope, right, that things
yes.
can come back from being slaughtered and decimated. So the power to destroy is ours, but also the power to create and reestablish. Let me tell you about next week's show, and then we'll say goodbye to Will. Next week, author, blogger, Zen priest, and punk bassist Brad Warner joins me again, this time to discuss his latest book. It's called Don't Be a Jerk. So here we are, World Peace Diet, Don't Be a Jerk. And other practical advice from Dzogchen, Japan's greatest Zen master. It's one of my favorite teachers. And so I'm looking forward to this book, giving practical advice from a modern standpoint about that great master. So that should be fun. And so we've got a double whammy of Zen here this week and next week from two Zen-centered people. But I want to thank Will Tuttle for being with me today. So thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for the great work you're doing. It's really, I'm honored to be able to contribute. And thanks so much, Reverend Paul.
All right. I'm sorry about the glitch, folks, with my headset. Back to square one. Just didn't mm-hmm. work, but we'll see what we can do for next week. And thanks for listening. And like I say, tune in next time. All right. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
It is the birthright of each and every one of us to live an awakened life. Most religions and spiritual traditions teach us that we need to adopt a certain belief system or follow some prescribed steps to attain a state of enlightenment. A long-held belief about awakening is that only a small number of people destined to become gurus or spiritual teachers can attain it. It is certainly true that until recent times, only a small number of people on the planet had attained this state of full self-realization. These saints, mystics, and spiritual masters were seen as special. They certainly were, at the time. However, times are changing. This message was brought to you by T.J. Woodward, host of Awakened Living Radio. Learn more from T.J. on his weekly podcasts. Episodes are available on UnityOnlineRadio.org, iTunes, and Google Play Music.
Truly understand the laws of the universe and live a life based on these profound and unwavering truths, then your dream life starts today. No more waiting, no more wandering. If you're ready to let go of the striving and move into the allowing, you're ready for Everyday Attraction on Unity Online Radio. We study the teaching of Abraham given to us by beautiful Esther Hicks, so we can release confusion for clarity, exchange struggle for serenity, and have the time of our lives today. Join host Ray Zander every Friday at noon Central Time, 10 a.m. Pacific, on Unity Online Radio for Everyday Attraction, where the law of attraction gets real.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.